Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want to give me a little check?
Hey there. How are you?
Hey there. So your birthday's March 10th.
That's right.
One day before me.
Oh, shit.
I'm 11.
Pisces.
Do you subscribe and buy into and take interest in star signs and astrology and all of that?
I guess I wouldn't put, like, I wouldn't plan my life by it, but I certainly don't discount it as, like, you know, there were so many years where human beings were alive and they only had the stars to, you know, that was the main show.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, indicate what life is about, why are we here, you know, these like deep-seated philosophical questions. As soon as our brains could start to ask those kind of questions, like pre-religion or whatever, you're looking at the stars, and they had the time, because there wasn't any distractions, to correlate the movement of the stars with what was going on in their lives, and somehow there's enough correlations that it's still around today. So I would not say that I'm like real into it or that I know a lot about it, but you know, it's kind of nice when you read your horoscope and it's like something cool or you're like, shit, that's happening to me right now. Damn.
Well, I was reading up today about the, I guess, the strengths, the characteristics, the weaknesses, mm-hmm. the qualities which make up a typical Pisces.
Right.
And I was going through the list and I was like, this is almost me to a T.
Same.
These things like intuitive, emotional, sensitive, compassionate, weaknesses perhaps is you're prone to sadness,
mm-hmm.
over-trusting sometimes, all these things. And I was just like, tick, 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 like that's kind of all me.
Yeah. And I think it's cool. I like being a Pisces. I'm happy with it, that sign.
One thing that I read, though, is that we do all right on our own. And I'm not that way.
No?
How about you?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah. On this tour, Siv was saying, like, you know, he doesn't do well on his own, you know, like where I will just go off for a walk every day. You know what I mean? Some people are just like want to be around people.
I guess because you've been traveling, all of you, on 3 buses.
Yeah, I want to get off campus.
All dudes as well.
You know, one thing I don't like, I love the company of women.
Me
it's
too.
Awesome.
Well, I grew up. Did you grow up with just your mum as well? Did I hear or read that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
so I my parents broke up when I was 12,
mm-hmm.
and my dad kind of wasn't around that much from then on.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a relationship, but we're not really close.
Right.
So my household was me, my mum, my sister. And now I live with a girl who's not a girlfriend, but a friend.
Uh-huh.
And I really thrive in the presence and the company of females, because for me, I think it allows me to open up another side of my personality that perhaps when you're hanging out with the guys, which I do love as well, you're perhaps not allowed that forte.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
I love to be in the company of women. It is just cool. But you know, on this tour that we were on, there was no women at all, you know, and you know, there's this saying like sausage fest or something like that. And I just think it's so stupid. It's just like, you know, it's cool to be around your friends. It's awesome. Like there's nothing bad about it. You know, if they had a band with females on it, I would be super into it. But I just like people as people. That's how evolved I am. I'm just into it.
It's just, it's on the person and the characteristics of the individual
rather than the
skin tone or who you sleep with or
sex.
Whatever else.
Yeah. And everyone on this last trip was, you know, we all had a common thread, but we had never spent so much time with each other. So it was like a real holiday camp thing.
It seemed like that. And I was down in the pit from, I guess, Street Dogs on.
Uh-huh.
And just watching, and you know, very much I find the case with a lot of hardcore shows and tours of that kind is the stage is populated heavily with friends and family as well. It's not like a closed stage environment.
Yeah.
And everybody's just like getting into it and it's a party.
Yeah. I recently read, you know, with GB, it's like amazing. We get so many good, like I'm on Instagram, so I'm checking out people saying, oh my God, I love the show. I read this one comment the other day that was like, not like that. And it was complaining about, you know, I know they're having a good time with their thing, but all these guys on stage, you know, they're like distracting from the show, you know, more or less or something like, you know, something along those lines, but in a more, in my opinion, dickish way of saying that. And my thought was like, that is what hardcore is about. You know what I mean? Like we played CBGBs, like your friends will be on stage. Those are the people that support you in this totally crazy pursuit, and they deserve to be represented up there, and them being close is empowering the whole thing. And like, and if someone from the audience wants to be on the stage and take that place, you take it, go,
come on up,
you know, let's do it. And it made me think about that, though, this comment, you know. So like I read it, doesn't like, you know, it doesn't piss me off personally, but it just says like an opinion. It's a fair opinion. You don't like that.
Perhaps it comes from a place of that person wanting to be up there themselves.
Something like that. I think this guy, to be honest, if I were to like tell you my real true opinion, it's more along the lines. I think he was a little bit, you know, because there was a mix of bands on this bill.
Yep.
You know, whereas Agnostic Front are the, you know, basically they're invented what we do.
Yeah.
You know, more or less. And GB has this kind of like more posy kind of like, I think more friendly kind of vibe. And
Fun as well.
And fun. And, you know, H2O, although they didn't play the night, kind of fit that as well. I think Street Dogs was like a cool like rock band. I loved them. And, you know, and a lot of the other bands are like heavy bands.
More metallic.
More metallic. Yeah. And this guy was a snob about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, dude, get over yourself. Like, this is a family. That's what hardcore, everybody's welcome. Don't be a snob.
I find it really interesting from your story is, I guess you were there right on the front line when hardcore morphed perhaps from that first wave of like the Murphy's Law, the Agnostic Front.
Yes.
And then I guess a lot of those bands came from perhaps broken backgrounds, perhaps a lot more of a criminal element, or at least a kind of drug, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sketchy.
Uh-huh.
But then I guess the next wave, which you guys led off with, You For Today and bands like this, it was more about education and the message. And would that be safe to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think really, I would credit Ray Capo with that sort of stylistically and also philosophically taking like New York scene, which was, you know, had all the bones were there, but it was really kind of in a limbo state when I first started going to shows, because, you know, those initial Agnostic Front, those initial blast of bands, it was a very small group of people that were there for those shows. And I was too young. I didn't make it. So when I got in there, that wave was dying, and those bands were looking for a new audience, so they were going like towards metal things. You know, the biggest bands would be like Corrosion of Conformity or like DRI, like crossing over, gaining metal fans. And Ray Capo from Youth Today with Youth Today, when I first heard that single, I was like, oh my god, this sounds like the hardcore that I wanted to be there for. This sounds like Minor Threat. Sounds like, well, not Minor Threat. They more sound like SSD or you know, that kind of a negative approach.
Yeah.
But the message of it, while I totally related to Murphy's Law message, you know, for the most part, like, it's about fun.
Yeah.
And Agnostic Front's obviously Victim and Pain record is like, I fully back, you know, philosophically, and like, you know, it's definitely like written in my heart. But Youth Today really just drove it home with such a succinct, you know, style, and that it really just, and also combined with his charisma and ability to organize and to get people from the New York scene, like Rabies or, you know, Vinny, Roger and those guys, to kind of work with them to build a scene, you know, where there'd be like bands would play, you know, where there'd be a community. And that community, like any sort of scene, like once there's like a sort of enough people kind of doing the same thing from different angles, they get like healthily competitive with each other.
You strength go, in numbers.
Yeah, you go see one band, you know, next 1 week and kind of don't rate them too high. And then you see them again, like, you know, like a month or so later, and they got some new song that's kind of got a badass mosh part.
Because they've been taking note of what the other guys are doing. And
yeah, because they're like,
to up their game.
Exactly. So I hear that mosh part and I'm like, damn, I got to do something like to kind of get up to that stage, because, you know, I'm out there feeling it. You know what I mean? And hardcore, you know, I think it must still be true. Like, it's so, you feel it. You're risking, you're throwing, you know, the ultimate expression is the dive into the void of a stage dive, you know, but you're counting on people to catch you with the very real possibility that they won't.
It's a leap of faith, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's a leap, and you feel it. And if you're in the pit, you know, I can remember being in the pit for Agnostic Front and being like, holy shit, like, I might die here. I need to figure out how to get out of this storm of bodies.
Big, older, yeah, burly dudes as well, right?
Yeah, in just, many cases. You know, I was a skinny kid, you yeah know what I mean? But, you know, you're in a, you know, if you've ever been knocked over in a.
I took a hit to the face last night taking photos.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I was like, that's a badge of honor. Like,
it's a part
you're
of
amongst
the,
it. You're in it.
Yeah, it's like tangent. Trenches. You know what I mean? It's like real physical thing. So you feel that in your body, and you like take a hit for something, for someone's mosh part, where you're like, it's a battle cry or whatever. It's like, it's the kind of thing that makes people run into battle, you know, as insane as that is. And so that cross-pollination with all these different people where they didn't have enough time, or, you know, they all had, everyone had, you know, maybe 10 records in common, but there was a, depending on like, some people's first record was Suicidal Tendencies. Some people's first record was, you know, Crass. Some people's first record was The Amoebic. Some people's first record was Minor Threat. Some people's first record was Corrosion of Conformity, or they got into it through Metallica, or, you know, some other kind of pathway. And so all these different mixtures bouncing off of each other really made this scene really amazing. But anyway, that's a very long-winded answer. I would say...
There are no short answers in podcast, Walter. It's all good.
Okay.
We can just wax.
So I would say, you know, getting back to the, I think what the original point was, yeah, I would credit Ray with that change of color with the scene. And it was, and Ray B's, and, you know, a lot of these kind of like, you know, Roger was definitely involved in that, but like creating matinees, because AF were out playing around the country. So like New York became the local scene. And that was like, you know, for people that know about it, it was pretty amazing.
It's such a surreal concept now, because they're just not done, are they? These kind of afternoon shows.
It'd be
so great if they still were.
And it was such a cool location too, because I mean, CBGB's, I knew what CBGB's was before I knew what hardcore was, you know? So, you know, and the first time I tried to go to CBGB's, I was just too scared to walk in, because I just thought like, I'm going to get killed or stabbed or whatever, you know, whatever movie I had seen.
Yeah. Well, how did the parents feel about a venue like that? Was it very much on their radar as this den of iniquity? Or
I think for me, my mom wasn't worried about it. You know, she was pretty like, as long as I got home at not such a late hour, and that's the beauty of a matinee.
Yeah,
you go
right.
To the matinee, you're there all day, and you get home by, you know, 9 o'clock or something like that. I mean, you know, there would be people that would be out all night and getting fucked up and doing that stuff. But I, you know, I was pretty. I had school. I was keeping it.
Were you ever okay. an unruly child? Did you ever get into the alcohol or the drugs in any way? Or was it more that you'd see those older kids and what those substances did to them that put you off doing it?
There was probably a few times where I realized I was hanging out with the wrong kids.
Right.
You know, it's like these kids are down to do stuff that I know is just not going to a good place. And I should slide away from this group of people.
At a young age, you realize that.
Yeah. But I mean, I didn't feel like, although there was like a zealotry to like when I became straight edge, because it was connected to the band I was in and the direction that I felt this music scene should go in. And
was that with Youth Today?
So with Youth Today, yeah. And also just inspired by them, you know, yeah. Like we all became straight edge. Like I wanted to be straight edge because Minor Threat was my favorite band, but then Youth Today created a way that we could be straight edge and be a part of this thing that was happening like right then and there. So that was very appealing. And then, you know,
and did veganism come at the same time or a little bit later?
No, vegetarianism came a little bit later. and by like a little bit, you know, it might've been 6 months or, you know, it's all happening pretty quickly, but you know, Ray added straight edge to the, I mean, added vegetarianism to straight edge. And then you had to be, you couldn't just be straight edge. You had to be vegetarian too, to really be legit. And,
What happens if you weren't? Were you almost like discluded?
It's just like, no, that's cool, dude. Kill the animals.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're straight edge. I guess that's all right. You know, but
I'm not pissed off. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah, it's sort of like that. Yeah, exactly. So I'd be like, all right, I guess killing animals is cool for you. I just kind of am a little bit of a better person than that.
Yeah.
That was kind of the attitude of it. And yeah, there was a zealotry to it, but I think it was in a positive direction. You know what I mean? And those lessons, although, you know, in my relationship to like alcohol or whatever, I wouldn't say that I was like, you know, really getting into any trouble or anything like that. I wasn't like, so for me to stop drinking wasn't like a huge thing. Vegetarianism was a bit harder, you know, because I just didn't, I was young. I didn't even know like eating vegetables was just like not my favorite thing.
And, you know, back then it wasn't a thing, was it? Obviously people were doing it, but it wasn't known of or accepted, or you know, now there's so much education and accessibility and availability,
yeah.
And it's very easy, I think, now to live that lifestyle.
I think it's definitely become more mainstreamed. I mean, it's incredible to see. I mean, we were like, when we got into it, it was like hippies, like leftover hippies, like a granola, Gorp kind of, you know,
wearing
Sprouts
hemp shoes,
like, yeah, shit like that,
yeah.
And I worked, we all worked at health food stores in Manhattan, like me, Siv, at multiple. So we would all, you know.
Were they like gathering places for creatives and musicians and artists?
In hardcore,
well?
very much. Like all the health food stores were filled with hardcore people. And at that time, they were all independently owned health food stores, owned generally by either, like the one that I worked at most was owned by Swami Satchidananda, who was like a, you know, a guru, and Down to Earth was like owned by like an old, you know, hippie, and a lot of them were owned by hippies or by gurus or both, and it wasn't capitalism,
which goes hand in hand with punk DIY.
Yeah. It was a nice fit.
And ideologies, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
We don't want to do what everybody else is doing. We don't want to go and eat McDonald's and
no,
so buy into that.
Yes, I mean there was lots of. It's like when you're at an age, like when you're a teenager and you're going or you're going into your early 20s, it's a really cool place because in some ways people will say, you don't know anything. You haven't lived. You don't understand like the complexities of like what you've been beat by life. You know that there's like the answers aren't simple, but you're also really smart in a way. Because you can look at a problem, you can look at a thing and say, here's what I think is right. And I can go towards that in a more clear way. Whereas as you get older, you know, you see so much more nuance. And I think a lot of people lose sight of those initial.
It gets convoluted, doesn't it, in your head?
It can, because, you know, there's things are not all black and white. You know what I mean? But that compass, it's a good thing to have that set early. And I feel like, you know, vegetarianism was a great one, and also straight edge was a great one to recognize or to contemplate the fact that, okay, on the one side, drinking is fun, you know, makes people act silly. You know, it's fun. It's great. For some people, it's not like that at all.
It's destructive.
It's bad. And people get bad
and dark
and yeah. dark, and they do things that they regret. And so to understand the dangers of that, and that, you know, and know where that's coming from. And a lot of people that were into straight edge, I think, probably came from homes where they were experiencing that, you know, like alcoholism in their household and, you know, troubles with that. but having that experience, especially at that time in my prime drinking years, you know, where I could have really got stupid,
yeah,
is a good kind of place, I think, for me in throughout my life.
A foundation.
Yeah, to just know, to monitor, like, okay, are you going too far with this? You know what I mean? Are you in the spirit of fun here, or is this dark? You know, and vegetarianism, I feel like vegetarianism, it just branches into so many different things, and not just veganism, but just consciousness about what's happening with our world. And this is in the 80s, you know what I mean? Like, you talk about, you know, what it takes to, like, make all these hamburgers. I mean, it's just like, you don't have to love cows to see what's happening to the forests and the use of resources, and how interconnected that is with so many ills, and, like, you know, war and famine and all this kind of crap.
Greed,
you know, yeah. and you know, having been exposed to that at that time when I was, like, I think, of course, young and experienced, but also righteous, because I had not done it. I hadn't sold out in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I was made aware of, like, what is the straight line that you're trying to, like, go for. And that was where the zealotry came from. And I felt like I believed in our cause 100%. Like, I wanted to convert everybody to straight edge vegetarianism, and hardcore music played in the spirit of the kind of initial 81 to 83 kind of vibe, like, and with mosh parts.
How successful was that quest with the work that you did, both on record and in the live environment with Youth of Today and then Gorilla Biscuits?
Massively.
Yeah? Like, yeah. You firsthand saw the wave of
every
change.
Night,
and
every night. We'd play.
Amazing.
Especially Youth Today. I mean, GB was not that like that. Youth Today was, I mean, basically we were trying to convert everybody to Ray's thinking. You know what I mean? Ray was the leader, for sure.
And you played bass in that band,
bass,
right?
Yeah.
So were you always, like, multi-instrumentalist, or is it just kind of like, it's punk rock, do it yourself, pick it up,
Yeah, I mean, bass, it's, to me, like, some people can't play bass and guitar, but I can play bass. I love playing bass. It's cool. It's, like, less strings, and it's about what you don't do. But in hardcore and in Youth Today, it just means you can go off more because it's not as difficult.
Yeah.
So I love playing bass. But anyway, yeah. Youth Today, definitely, you know, to me, when I say massively, I think of, like, I'm not saying Youth Today is responsible for this, but you look at the value of the people that were into Youth of Today and where they are now. These are people in positions of power in media companies and all kinds of environmental organizations and
probably chefs that have been pioneers of certain cuisines.
Absolutely.
Down the vegetarian line. And
so many. And so many progressive and cool parts of society, from, like, you know, top down, you know, there's, like, billionaires that are into this stuff. And
it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It's amazing. So I would say, not like Youth Today made all this happen. No, but we represented for those values and those ideas in a really clear, succinct, and, you know, put ourselves out there for abuse.
Yeah.
Kind of a way. And you know, when we were playing every night, I especially in Europe, it was like, but even around the United States, you know, we were going around the punk scenes in around the country here in the United States, and you could see the kind of leftover, the remnants of the scene that had, you know, brought Black Flag and, you know, all those bands, that first wave of bands. Like, it was just like, there was nothing to fill the vacuum. And youth today would come in and be like, holy shit, thank you. Someone is telling us where to go, you know? And that was a really nice thing about it, you know, whatever. I'm just talking up youth today, but that's how it affected me.
Yeah.
So it's like, I didn't form the band. I was asked to join it. And, you know, at that time it was like, holy cow, I've just been asked to join, you know, freaking Radiohead.
Yeah, that's what it felt like.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a bad comparison, but you know what I mean? But
an iconic band.
An iconic band that I thought was badass, and I was into not just for the music, but for the mission.
Did you never want to step up to the plate with Gorilla Biscuits and be the voice piece? Or were you happier just kind of experimenting with songwriting and developing more in that way for that time?
I think when I started the band, it was, I was playing guitar and singing, and it just was obvious to me after a while, like, you need to have a front man for a hardcore band.
You got to hold core.
Yeah, you need the guy to up there with the microphone. So my options were, I'm going to find someone else to play guitar, in which case I would have to give up that kind of whatever direction. I'd then have to find a guitar player that was really cool and inspired me.
Yeah.
Or Siv is awesome. And has
what was he doing at that time?
Siv was he worked at the laundromat, and you know, he was into hardcore.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And he's just cool. He's just like,
he reminds me. I would say that Matt from the Bronx has clearly been inspired mm-hmm. by him. There's a very similar stage craft and the way he interacts with the audience, kind of funny, cheeky,
yes,
bravado but likable.
Exactly.
I can definitely see that influence that's fed down to him.
Yeah, I guess
because they're both skinheads.
yeah. I guess I would. I see that actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but it's true. They have a similar charm.
Yeah,
and they're just cool guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're cool guys,
like tough dudes, but they're cuddly and personable.
Exactly. Like they both have that similar gift. So Siv's just cool, and even when he had hair and at that age, and so he was the guy, and he was just like pretty. Like, let's make this band. You want to sing? Okay. And then we just went from there, and we didn't, you know.
Is that the band that got you out in New York touring further afar?
Eventually. I mean, we started off like very low on the totem pole. Like we didn't like, we had a pretty weird, like Gorilla Biscuits was a pretty weird name at the time. So we probably were pretty out of it, to be honest. And it was only from just going to shows, you know, trying to persist to get on more shows. And then finally, when we got a record, we got a chance to like show what we could do. And the records were what did it. It wasn't like a lot of bands would come out and then would just come out,
just crush
the box, just like had the look, had the sound, had the crew. Like a band like YDL, like I guess in some ways they're controversial now because of their, you know, skinhead kind of thing. And I just think they were kids. I don't think they really understood what the hell they were talking about, you know? But they came out strong, you know, like the look was right. It all made sense. Gorilla Biscuits was way more like kind of all over the place.
What is this? Yeah.
And so it took us a while. I think it took till our recordings came out. And, you know, we adopted the straight edge thing, but that wasn't our primary focus.
Was that more about having fun, that band, at that time?
Yeah, it just was fun.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted it to be serious.
I mean, last night was amazing.
Oh,
it was so much fun.
Thank you.
I've never seen a guy smile more than you were smiling.
Oh, man.
Night.
Does
it feel almost like a holiday playing in that band at this stage?
Of course it does. It's magic. I'm with my best friends from like high school.
Yeah.
Like traveling in a bus and like playing these songs that still are so meaningful to us and to everybody in the room. You know what I mean? I'm not saying like we're the best band or anything, but it's like these songs resonate. It's a fact, you know, and that it makes people happy and it brings people together. And
as you say, all these years on as well.
Yeah, and it's not
amazing.
Just, and it's like people my age and their children,
mm-hmm.
and you know, people that got it, like we're one of the kind of last guys intact from our world, you know, and we still got jumps, you know, so I think it's a cool thing to see younger people pick it up too. Like younger people, it makes me sound like a grandpa, but you know, people in their 20s,
it moves so quickly now, doesn't it? The pace of life,
yeah,
it's crazy. I mean, but I guess it always did, because what was happening in New York, I mean, it seemed like every 6 months there was like a new scene.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And this is pre-internet and before that speed of technology and information, but it was just, there was so much, I guess, creativity happening.
Yeah. And I mean, it was just a good, I mean, I think a lot of...
It dated so quickly in some cases, didn't it?
I think a lot of the, you know, the structure of a scene kind of works the same all around. It's like somebody has a vision and, you know, puts it out there, connects to like two or three other people. Then you have like a group and then a fourth one. And then the idea of the group of the identity of that scene starts to crystallize. And then once it finally crystallizes and it's at this thing and people know what that is, then soon after that, people start getting away from it because they don't want to be in that. And it just has to redo itself. Mm-hmm. It's like a wave coming in and going back out. And it was cool to see with that New York scene, but it was sort of like, you know, scattered around. And then over the course of a year or something, it really crystallized super hard, regular shows all the time. And
were there many people from the business side facilitating and directing, whether it's managers or agents, or do you know what I mean? Because sometimes you have these like Svengali type figures that are noticing patterns and...
But it was so low rent because there's no money in it. You know what I mean? So
they weren't looking at it and going, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Some people maybe were a bit, you know, like they saw the potential in Agnostic Front, you know, like crossing over to metal scene. But even then, like it wasn't, I guess maybe they were thinking along Metallica lines, but Metallica weren't Metallica then. Metallica were like, you know, a band that could play to like, you know, 1,500 people or something, like ravenous fans. They weren't competing with, you know, Bon Jovi or
Guns N' Roses.
You know, around that time, there's a lot of hair metal, and Metallica kind of cut through that eventually.
But were you into that stuff growing up, like rock and roll? And
I liked AC/DC. I liked that kind of like classic. Right, yeah, I love them. I mean, that's my main influence would be Angus Young on guitar. And, you know, so like hard rock stuff like that, you know, I'd be into like Judas Priest because that's what kids were into.
Yeah.
You know, but I never would say that genre was my thing. I just was kind of like, you know, I would like Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, you know, the kind of like basics, the Doors.
Yeah. Just great songwriting, isn't it? But you're saying is you didn't go to one of those shows and feel like, this is home.
No, not so much. I'm kind of like, around, you know, I'm a little bit all over the place. But one thing that I did get into was that was really got such a great education for us. There was a radio station in Long Island called LIR, and they would play all imports from UK.
Right.
So
the UK music was affecting you.
Oh man,
when
Blancmange was coming out, or like Hazy Fantasy, the Smiths. I heard the first Smith single when it played.
Is that a lot of the stuff which later on, would you say, perhaps influenced the Rival Schools stuff?
I mean, it's definitely cooked into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also in GB. Like, you know, there's definitely like things that if I went through it, I could say, yeah, that's ripped from, I mean, we covered the Buzzcocks, for example.
Yeah.
You know, all that, at that time, like all this incredible music was coming out. I heard U2 on LIR too, and that was just like, I mean, U2 now is like this massive, unbelievable thing, but there was a time when they were just like a band in the pack, you know?
Like REM as well.
Yeah, REM. I love them.
Alternative, underground, progressive, really interesting.
They were incredible, and it's hard to like remember that past the hugeness of them, but at one time they were just like amazing. I mean, I saw them, I think when Nirvana hit, I felt like REM was really manifested in a major way, or like, you know, the Replacements.
Love them.
Also manifest, you know, is taking REM.
Well, those bands were almost, there was like obviously the Black Flag kind of era. And then you had Husker Du, Replacements.
Yeah.
I guess they were like the stepping stone, the middle gap, weren't they, between Black Flag and Nirvana.
Yeah, they had a pop sense.
People were like, Nirvana came from out of nowhere. And it's like, well, no, if you trace it back, it was kind of from hardcore and punk and then that kind of alt.
So you follow those.
Country-infused indie rock in some places.
And like, the kind of unintelligible lyrics, vocals, and you know, some of the cadences, the kind of like, you know, these kind of like Michael Stipe has this real kind of sad sense of melody
that
I think Kurt Cobain had as well.
Absolutely.
and you know, and also has ties to Morrissey, although I don't know that Kurt Cobain would have been a Smiths fan, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was.
Is New York still home?
New York's still home. I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Has it always been the base?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I grew up there, and I lived in Berlin for a while. I lived in Ohio for a little while.
Home of Devo, how was that?
Oh, it was cool. I went there in high school. My dad lived there, so I went and spent a year in Ohio. This is actually before I got into hardcore, or before I got, you know, kind of going to shows. And yeah, it was cool. Like, Necros were the local band. And but anyway, it was more like just like American, you know, like when you watch movies from the 80s, like Breakfast Club or whatever.
Yeah, of course,
like
kinda, yeah.
That idea of American high school. Like, that's what Ohio was like. So it was really fun because New York high school is not like that at all.
A lot more tough and gritty?
It's more like Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
You know, I feel my junior high was like, I could get through.
Back against the wall.
I feel like I could get through a female's like security, like not maximum security, but like whatever level security that prison is on.
You could navigate those.
I feel
seas.
Like I could get through it for a while.
Because you've got the training in there.
Yeah, there's something in there that I could survive it.
Love it.
But so going to Ohio was really awesome, and I made great friends, and I had a great time. But yeah, primarily New York.
And hip-hop, obviously, I think, because I've always been fascinated by hip-hop, but uh-huh. I've been watching recently the great show on Netflix called Hip Hop Evolution.
Uh-huh.
And it traces it from literally the ground zero, DJ Herc's first block party, all the way through all the stages.
Yeah.
And there seemed to be a similar sort of thing happening in that these kids who had no hope were organizing in the same way that perhaps the hardcore scene was. And they were like, rather than this inter-gang bullshit, like, let's get together because the government's not looking out for us.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look out for each other and try and build mm-hmm. something that's positive. And then obviously that fed into graffiti and breakdancing.
Sure.
And turntablism. And were you aware of that as a kid, and were you taking those trips to that side of town and being exposed to that on the live side? Or
I mean, initially I didn't see, it was just like what was happening in junior high, you know, like people would just like rap, and like there'd be all the kids like, you know, double dutching and mm-hmm. chant, and that was what was popular coming up. And the early hip hop in New York was all in New York on independent record labels from New York. So that was the sound of just life, you know?
Yeah.
And as it progressed and, you know, I got into hardcore and, you know, independent records started to become more familiar with that. Then you start to see like how hip hop was also following that, although on a bigger scale, because it was way more popular.
Yeah, it kind of hit pretty fast, didn't it? After Sugar Hill Gang, it was almost like raps everywhere, rapping Rodney, and it's like in pop culture. And
it was in pop culture, but it was a faddish thing.
Yeah,
it was
right,
it wasn't like real hip hop. I'm thinking more.
But then
of
Run DMC comes out, right? And it's
I'm thinking more like, you know, Eric B. Rakim, or mm-hmm. like independent record labels like I guess Def Jam was at one point, or was it Fourth and Broadway, First Priority, who put out like Audio 2 and MC Lyte. This homemade quality that you knew all these labels were just like selling 20,000 records maybe if they were successful, and you just knew it was like two or three dudes putting it together
and selling them, like
selling them,
cars,
yeah, where they could, getting them distributed, like going, it's, you know, just like hardcore, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they'd have the markets, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Like the cassette markets where you could just go and pick up all the latest mixtapes.
But they didn't have national radio support until, you know, even when Run DMC hit, it wasn't like the floodgates exactly had opened. You know what I mean? You could get in like sort of not massively catchy Ice Ice Baby kind of singles.
Yeah.
But it took a while before like radio formats really just switched over to it, and that just changed it completely. But at that time, it was just the music that that was around us always. And, you know, that was what was playing in the clubs. And, you know, I'd go out as a teen, I wasn't even drinking, but going out to clubs, you know, and yeah, dudes would be like, Rakim would be at the club. Chuck D would be at the club. You'd see these people out, Big Daddy Kane, just like hanging out. And that was like, you know,
normal.
And a white geek just like me, like hanging out.
What about the filmmakers at that time? Like the kind of Jim Jarmusch
would have been
Spike Jones. Were all those guys just sort of knocking around as well?
They would have been a little bit out of my off my radar, like the kind of like a older generation kind of group of people. Of course I knew the films, but it wasn't what I was painted. I wasn't like into film as much at that time, you know.
Was skateboarding the other huge thing as well?
Skateboarding is another big thing.
Yeah.
You know, so skateboarding was, you know, in street skating, when I started skateboarding, it was about ramp skating and, you know, bowls and stuff like that. You know, looking at Thrasher magazine, it'd always be like someone, you know, doing some sort of, you know, air out of a bowl or something like that. And New York City was not, you know, street skating was not recognized really, but you'd go to like,
because I guess there was no money in sponsorship in it, right? In the same way that there was with these big competitions.
Not at that time, no. Yeah. And so, but they were inventing street skating. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd go to Washington Square Park and they'd be like jumping garbage cans, you know, ollieing garbage cans and, you know, rail sliding off of like all this kind of stuff. And there was the Brooklyn Banks, which was just like under the Brooklyn Bridge, this just like slope. And you just like skate up it and skate down, you know, do whatever, you know, doing slides on it and, you know, the kickflip getting invented.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, which I can remember is now you just take for granted all these things.
I can remember when the kickflip got invented and it was just like, I'm out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the shape of boards that? Like changed and, but yeah, skateboard, street skating at least. I mean, the kind of ramp skating and all, you know, that was a thing and that's what if you look back at Thrasher, I think that was probably maybe what was more stressed. And New York was not the mecca for skateboarding, although it was developing the style, and which is ultimately what people care about, I think, right now. You know,
it's mad, just perfect time for alternative culture across the board, I think.
And I feel hip-hop, connected to all
punk
that.
Punk rock, skateboarding,
yeah.
It was all one and the same, wasn't it?
And you look at the people that were doing that kind of stuff at that time, like I'm still in music. And I'm, you know, lucky to be doing it.
And did you always know it was going to be the career once things started?
No, not at all. No, I mean, what kind of psychopath would start their career in like the worst sounding kind of music ever?
Yeah.
I was doing it so I could play CBGBs. I was doing it so that I could like affect other people the way that I was being affected. You know what I mean? I wanted to make people mosh like they were making me mosh, you know? I wanted to create an atmosphere where people would stage dive and freak out, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And I didn't see any potential really beyond like, you know, filling CBGBs, selling out CBGBs would be like, okay,
I've made it.
That's our, we did it.
When was the turning point then with Quicksand?
Yeah, I guess maybe that. Towards the late 80s, you know, just like, I guess I was describing how the scenes just kind of hit a, it sort of got very popular with kids coming from the suburbs. So, you know, so kind of hand in hand with gentrification too of the Lower East Side. So kids finally, you know, I told you when I first went to see, I was scared of going in. Just the neighborhood was scary at that time. And now it just kind of got out that, no, you can survive. It can be done. And so it got really, yeah, a lot of kids from the suburbs.
Is that a good and a bad thing?
I thought it was really cool because, yeah. I mean, from the music standpoint, there's just more people there. So from my point of view, it's great. You know, like the scene's getting more popular. And then and as a result, we could go out and play in Connecticut. We could go play in deep in New Jersey. We could go to like more further afield because it was being accepted in the suburbs. And so it just made it bigger. I mean, it was big in California too. So I thought it was cool. I think at a certain point as the bands just kind of either went on tour, like I remember started going on tour. So then we weren't around anymore. So the bands that were coming up, there was a lot of good bands coming up, but the scene just kind of lost its wind. The wind just went out of it. And so even though these bands were great, there wasn't enough there anymore to like get a third wave out of it.
And hold it all together.
And hold it, yeah. And a lot of people found out about it that weren't good, and a lot of violence came into the scene.
Again,
yeah, I think more so. Like it came back in, like, oh, there's a cool thing going on with a bunch of nerds from the suburbs. I can go there and
steal their girlfriends,
feast
their
on
wallets.
It. Yeah, and that's what happened. So it didn't, like, I remember the last Gorilla Biscuit show we played, like, a guy got stabbed, like, within an inch of his life. I was like, no, this is not that fun for me. And, you know, they kind of splintered out. And there was a movement at ABC No Rio, which was a little art space on Rivington Street where it was like kind of all the nerds went. And I felt more related to that crew than at what was happening at CB's. And so I started a band called, it started as Moondog, where I was the singer. Finally, like, I'm going to do this thing where I'm singing.
And guitar as well.
I wasn't playing guitar. No, I was just the lead singer. And then that morphed quickly into Quicksand. You know, we got Alan Cage, who's the drummer. And when he joined the band, it sort of seemed like we just kind of dropped all the Moondog songs and started to write fresh songs. And I think we just benefited from the combination of all that great power from the CB scene, from this awesome experience, combined with a desire to do something out of the bounds of what that formula was.
Yeah.
And so we had all the goodness of it. We brought all the good qualities, but also were, you know, I think hardcore also has a very conservative streak.
Yeah. And you're restrained, aren't you? There's only so much you can do musically before it's like, that ain't this anymore.
And we hate you now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So you can't, like, you're not allowed to progress too much. And so feeling boxed in, you know, that was a band where I just felt like we can do something that we can just write off having to stick to that formula and just do something new. But we're informed from our history and of our experiences in this really cool scene, cool music scene, like hardcore, whatever. It was just like a bunch of creative people. I mean, I listened to songs, you know, like Outburst recently. Like Outburst were kind of on the later side for me. And I actually played in Outburst for a little bit, and I always thought they were cool. I never thought that they like really, I don't know if they were ever a headlining band at CB's. They might've been, but they're awesome. Like they've written so many really great songs, like just whatever, objectively, like if I'm teaching a college class on, or, you know, checking boxes on like what a good song is, like they've written great ones. There's a lot of geniuses. And, so, you know, kind of took that energy and just but went like, let's try something totally different, like let's let go of the guitar, or let's
were you drawing from any specific areas of influence, or were you more just inspired by each other? And
initially I was definitely knocked out by Jane's Addiction. I mean, they would have been they would have been the one that was like, here's a band that's rocking,
mm-hmm,
it's doing something like the Doors or something.
And Zeppelin in places.
And Zeppelin, yeah.
And then also like the Cure and Joy Division.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they were checking off these like so many cool from angles that we just like, it was like, that's the coolest band.
Yeah.
So, and also Fugazi were massively, they were just starting at that time. But Fugazi were also just like, you know, again, leading the way. Like Ian MacKay.
Yeah, I guess he showed that, you could do this one great era defining thing.
Yeah.
And then you could also go on to do another.
Yeah,
totally free, totally different.
Yeah. So we had
a brilliant thing.
We had a sort of a blueprint, you know, in that, or that it had been in Jane's Addiction. They were sort of like, they're in California, they're kind of like magic. We had no idea how the hell they figured that out. But on the Fugazi side, you know, they're bringing danciness into it, and this kind of open guitar feeling where it could be sort of sloppier or
what is that? Jazz atonal feel in there, in that,
yeah, kind of atonal in some ways, and I guess, you know, Ape made our own, like, kind of, we weren't lifting them exactly, but, you know, because you just, we couldn't do that, but we're kind of between, and also I loved Slayer at that time too.
You did,
yeah. I thought they were really cool. So kind of, I would say those three things. So there's like an element of you know, I think Seasons in the Abyss had come out at that time.
So Slayer's where that sort of heavy angle comes in from.
Yeah.
Experimentation, Fugazi and Janes. And
yeah, which is a really weird combination. But well, I think if you hear it, if you listen to it with that, maybe you might
100%,
be able to take some
that's
of those pieces.
Stones.
Yeah, so that's kind of where the thing was coming out. But also that might have been our idea, but like what comes out in the end is just like what it is, you know.
How was the, you know, the moment when you all got back together? Was it something like 21, 22 years?
Say again?
Quicksand, after you'd been gone long. Was it 21, 22?
Shit, man. I hate to think about it.
Are you all good?
Can we just stop for one
second?
Yes,
of course. Yeah, yeah. You need to reply, yeah.
Hold up. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So yeah, after over two decades, you reform and were you not separated? Was it just it was kind of
oh no we had
broken, hiatus and or
no
was it, it was done,
no we
it was
had
done.
Broken up. It was like, you know, a highly principled decision, and you know, we had just been touring so much, and you know, we're in this major label kind of grind, and
did it take some of the joy out of it?
Yeah, and I found it hard to like really recognize the success of what we were doing. And it just kind of got more boxed in, and we had a hard time like agreeing on anything. And
is that because you're all big personalities as well?
We're all big personalities, and so everyone's genius and
has a strong idea of what should be being done. And
yeah, and also like where you don't, if by giving in on this thing that you feel like you've lost somehow, and you're not relating to people as you're making, you know, we were just on the road too much around each other, like just dealing with, you know, which of course was fun and cool. But, at a certain point we were just like, you know, I was like, I don't need the grief anymore. Like, and it would have been wise to have said, okay, dude, I get that. Why don't we take off 6 months or, and then in 6 months, if we feel like we need to make this dramatic statement, then we'll do that. But for us, just being young and being like, you know,
passionate,
yeah. It's like, no, the story is, you know, we broke up on tour, you know, and, we can't, it's just unprincipled. If we're not committed for like,
is he 100% or zero?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I'm not saying that that's bad and that shouldn't be an ideal for people. You know, I think that's fine and cool, you know, but I just, in retrospect, I feel like we could have, you know, we didn't do ourselves any favors in like not giving it a bit of space. It was understandable. We had played like 300 dates or something in a year.
It's the age old story, isn't it? Because nobody from a managerial side is going to tell you guys to do that because they want to keep the money being made.
Yeah.
So they're just like, we're putting you out on another tour, get in the studio, make another record, repeat. And it's the age old story with so many bands that you wish you could have just gone, maybe we should have just had a pause there for a while. And
yeah, and you're constantly, especially at that time, you're looking at like SoundScan numbers, and if like you're not touring, your SoundScan goes down and the record label's not happy. These people that used to love you now are like disappointed in you or something like that, and all this kind of shit. And it's like, I don't need this garbage. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not getting paid enough to deal with this grief. And meanwhile, we were successful, you know, as successful as I had ever been. And which was cool to go out on a high point in that regard. So I don't think that that's bad.
And artistically as well.
Yeah, we had done great shit. It's all it kind of crystallized. I had a good, I mean, I didn't know, but I had a good sense that this would be safe and this would like travel well and, you know,
and stand the test of time.
And
stand,
I thought it would.
And it has.
And it, yeah, I'm happy about that. And so, you know, at a certain point in time, we got involved in the Revelation anniversary
show, yeah.
And
yeah.
So my friend, who's friends with all of us, you know, made the moves to like get us all to play together for this one thing.
Was Gorilla Biscuits on that label as well? Was that kind of like the
Gorilla
label?
Gorilla Biscuits on Revelation, yeah. Yeah. That was the main label.
That was like the Roadrunner Records of this world,
yes,
was it?
Yeah, for sure. And it had a run of at least like 20 plus records that were all solid, like amazing. So yeah, we played the anniversary and it was just like stunning, you know, like the response.
No bad blood at all, just...
Nah, you know, I mean, we were just had grown, you know, we didn't know as much about each other's, like, I mean, I was probably mostly tight with Sergio, the bass player, so I was kind of more up to date with him. But, you know, Tom I hadn't seen, or Alan I hadn't seen. And so, you know, it was cool to reconnect with, like, not, with some distance, to not be, like, pissed off about some whatever insignificant thing about whenever.
I guess enough time goes under the bridge and you forget what you fell out about in the first place.
Yeah,
right?
Usually it's often like that. So, you know, that, and then we thought, oh shit, that was amazing. So yeah, you know, maybe we did a tour like maybe a year later or something like that. And that went amazing too. So it's just basically like people really dig what we're doing. They love it. They feel like such connection to this music. And then after we had done that, we thought, well, how much can we just keep playing these songs? How interesting is that going to be? And when does it start to diminish, you know? And so, you know, should we try to record a record? It's probably, you know, how is it going to be good? Like, we don't know. Like, but what we did is, you know, kind of took the experience from the shows that we played and just took a risk. You know, I mean, if it was really bad, I think we probably would have put it out anyway because we paid for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, did you use the money that you made from the shows,
yeah,
essentially? Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So
straight back in.
Yeah. So so with knowing that, we really tried hard to make it good.
I guess that's good, right? There's pressure on you. It's
but
like,
it was
well, we
our
paid
pressure.
This out of our own pocket, and we're free to do what we want, but it should probably be good.
We should probably make it good.
Yeah.
And like, how do you make it good? You know, like, we have no idea what our place in all this stuff is. And like, what, you know, I'm not the same person as I was. And I've done so many things since that time. So how do I be who I am now and also connect to what it was at that time in some way that makes sense? And, you know, I think we just went for like, try our best. If we dig it, that's our best shot. If we think it's as good as we can make it, if we think it's cool, if we're thinking it's cool, that's probably our best chance of other people thinking it's cool. And, you know, because we don't have like a real formula. I guess we have a certain thing that we do, but it's not so easy to define.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even really a specific sound, is it? It's
just like somehow we get together. There's a combination of the elements
the
and
chemistry
the
and
style.
The alchemy,
yeah.
It?
That it kind of creates something. Like, we're not like a hardcore band or a funk band, or it's not like genre to like hit the same target. I felt like we had a couple songs or a few songs that I felt like were closer to what we had done, but from like a different angle, you know, from a more contemporary angle. But anyway, so we kind of just sprung it, and yeah, the response was amazing. It allowed us to go out and tour and to be contemporary, because like I mean, GB's kind of a separate thing. I feel like GB's like just like a celebration of the whole community.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about the band. I think it's about the whole.
And last night was a perfect example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel like the pressure to like interfere with that by throwing new music into it.
Because you're not worried about it being a nostalgia act, because kind of half of that is nostalgia in the sense that it's celebrating the scene.
Yeah.
As opposed to all the responsibilities on the shoulder of just that one band.
On an artistic statement.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know.
So you probably wouldn't look at doing new Gorilla Biscuits material.
Not too much. I mean, I think
it's not high on the
sometimes
priorities.
It's good to just know when to put the brush down,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But with Quicksand, I felt it was, for us anyway, and the way we are as people, like, we weren't about to just like, okay, run it down, you know, playing the old songs. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of have one or two bites at the apple with that. And then you have to at least from your own standpoint as an artist, come up with something just to hold it up, to give you a reason to go. And yeah, we had, you know, it was challenging, but really fun, actually. And so I think some of that, you know, I'm super proud of us, like, taking that leap and going for it. And, you know, and we're all such, you know, we have all become, like, really appreciate each other. You know, we're like good friends. And it's
so there'll
awesome.
Be more, you think there'll be?
Well, I don't want to hype it, you know,
right.
But
what will be will be.
Yeah, what will be. I would love to. So we'll, you know, don't be shocked or be shocked. You know,
dude, I could talk to you all day. I know you've got some dinner plans, yeah. So I'm going to let you go imminently. Before I do, we'll have to talk about rival schools and all the other stuff another time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of ask you the very broad question that might be difficult to answer, but I'm sure you'll have one. What's music in this life afforded you? What's it given you? What have you learned and taken from it?
I mean, initially with music, it was a, you know, it was like a friend, you know, a way to kind of get, you know, I mean, at first I remember like being into the Beatles or the Beach Boys or something. It's like learning about culture. It's about learning about the world out there that, you know, what are people doing out there? You know, as a kid, you can't go out in the street. You can't go to the shows or whatever thing. So you're like learning about culture. And like this, for me, it was the 60s because, you know, I was born in 1969. So like all the records that I was listening to in the 70s were primarily, you know, whatever, Crosby, Stills and Nash and stuff like that. But 60s music.
Yeah.
And early 70s. So, you know, you're kind
it's
of
a gateway into the world.
Yeah. You're learning about the world. You know what I mean? And going through your parents' record collection, learning about, you know, your parents, what they're into and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually, you know, as I got to be, you know, a little bit older, like music became my, you know, like I think for a lot of people that get into, you know, becomes your friend. You know, I could just like whatever was going on in my life, I could just listen to like an REM record and it just sounds like so crazy and cool. And I'm like that, I feel intimate with that. And or like, I remember getting Joy Division's record Closer and not knowing whether it's like called Closer or is the band called Joy Division or is the band called Closer, which it was. And just hearing these crazy sound of this band that and the what it was and like how that connected to like the kind of sadness and darkness in me and like made me feel okay about it. And learning how to play guitar, when I learned how to play guitar, it was like wanting to play like Angus Young or learn how to play a Dead Kennedy song or something, you know, to sort of feel, you know, what the feeling was of actually doing it. And then the fact that, you know, in high school, like I didn't like my high school. I mean, I had friends there. It wasn't like an awful experience, but it was sort of like, I just didn't fit in. And so, getting involved in like the scene at CBGBs and stuff like that brought me to a place with a lot of other people that were like banged up in one way or another and so many beautiful people and like to escape and to feel a kinship there, you know, an alternative high school. And then, you know, that's as I've been able to like, you know, do it as a career, I really feel like, you know, in songwriting and it's really been enabled me to travel the world, which is always something I wanted to do. You know, I have friends all over the world.
From music, right?
From music. Yeah. And these are lifelong friends, you know, like really important people in my life. And such a wide range of experiences that, you know, it's not for everybody, but to me, like that's what I'm interested in. And, you know, and writing songs and working with people in bands, I'm always learning about who I am, you know, like how do I treat people? How do I work with people? How do I cooperate? How do I stand up for an idea or how do I navigate, you know, whatever situation that I'm in creatively? And then what am I writing about, you know, and what do I want to write about? How do I want to explore? And, you know, these are all kind of ways of, you know, sometimes you're like really brave and take chances and sometimes you're like afraid and you're afraid of that weirdness. And I can't help but want to go towards those things that I'm like afraid of, you know, or feel they need to be explored, whether people are into it or not. Of course, I always would hope that they would be. But that is, I've been able to like low key make that into a career.
I guess that's the key, isn't it, with your story, is there's been so many different projects.
Yeah.
And all of them, I think, are held in great reverence by music fans, mm-hmm. but there was never like that one band that eclipsed everything else because it was so massively gargantually mm-hmm. successful. Mm-hmm. So it's never like that one thing trapped you. Do you know what I mean? You've been able to be free and...
Yeah, I think it's kind of by design. You
delve
know, like,
into whatever area you so desire.
I mean, it's like, it depends for which band, you know what I mean? Like for Gorilla Biscuits, like I have friends that... there's people that love Gorilla Biscuits and don't even know I'm in Quicksand, or people that love Rival Schools and have no idea I'm in Gorilla Biscuits, people that love Quicksand and don't care about any of that stuff, never even heard of it. And then there's people that follow the plot through all of them. And I don't know that it's a really awesome career strategy, because I think it's probably better to like kind of brand yourself in one thing and kind of keep knocking away at that probably.
Would you be happy?
I just didn't think in those terms, you know, and when I set on my path, and maybe because from hardcore, like hardcore bands to make one record, generally maybe two, but generally an EP and a record, and then you break up. And so I thought that's how you do it.
With all of them. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was only after like maybe after Rival Schools that I was like, oh shit, not every single band that you do like that, you know, become successful, and you got it. It actually, maybe it kind of helps to like stay with one thing.
Yeah, I love it.
You know, but it was kind of too late.
Too late then, yeah.
You know, so I guess this is just the career that I've got, and but it's afforded me the space to take chances, to be like, I can make a Rival Schools record and do things differently with different people than I did in Quicksand without having to like worry about the Quicksand record being like, this is the shit Quicksand record, you know what I mean, or something like that. And so, you know, it's like I feel like maybe with some of these things that were cut short, in the sense that I didn't have an idea for the next chapter, so it was easier for me to like just start from scratch. And that's cool. I've been lucky that I have been successful as I've been at doing that. But I would say like what I value out of it most is the scope of it. You know what I mean? That I've had the opportunity to try so many different things, and I've played with so many cool people that have like believed in that idea or added to it, or have been part of that story, because these are all like really, you know, cool, you know, meaningful relationships and experiences, you know. And that's like without having to like delve into the bullshit of like real pop world, although I've taken steps into that, I've always been able to keep it real, you know. And so I feel like pretty happy and content with that bit of it. And you know, I'm still thinking about new shit to do. You know, I have like so many projects that I want to do, you know. And I think it probably won't end, you know, because you're always just with this. And I think people are probably doing this in their own way throughout their lives, if they're asking questions about, you know, who are you? You know what I mean? Like, who am I now? What is that? How does that relate to where I'm going? And I just have been kind of doing that through music in a way, you know. And so sometimes I think I'm doing awesome shit and no one cares. And sometimes I'm thinking I'm doing something that's all right and people think it's great. Sometimes I think I'm doing something awesome and everyone else thinks it's awesome and that's the best. You know what I mean? But it works in all different ways. And so that's kind of cool, as my, you know, I wouldn't have expected it to be that way, but I'm pretty grateful.
Well, what I loved about last night at the end of the show is you jumped off the stage and took the time to shake pretty much every single person on the front row's hand.
Yeah.
And you were just beaming as much as they were. I could see you'd had the best night. And
yeah.
What a blessed life to be able to do what you love.
Oh my God.
And still love it this many years in, right? And as you say, still be excited, still be coming up with new ideas, still chasing different experiences and new musical avenues.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To have a nice home life and family and the best of both worlds, right?
It's I feel very blessed, and especially after a show like last night, where it's like, damn, you know, look at these, you know, we're all in the same gang here. This is like, Gorilla Biscuits without the audience is like not a thing. It's like, I mean, I guess you could say that about any band, but I think the participation, and especially with a barricade like that, it really is a pretty deep cut in our game, because stage diving is our bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, that chaos of that, which is dangerous, and I'm not saying that that's like all good, but for the people that came out and just like hung out and like were up on that barrier and doing that, like that they're in the band as much as I'm in the band, and it's just like awesome that we can come to England all these years later and have a show that's like everyone's feeling good, everyone's feeling up, and that's, whoa, yeah, you'd have to, it's humbling.
I'm really pleased that we got the chance to speak, especially today,
mm-hmm.
after this little run of shows as well.
Yeah, always. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for taking the time, mate. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed it.
Right on, same.
Enjoy Mildred.
Hell yeah, thanks.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.